Matt Segundo here, and I wish to object to this show's guest. You see, Pamela Ribbon has authored a book called Why Girls Are Weird. Now, normally I don't read these silly books. I have enough trouble reading my doctor's prescriptions or the instructions that come with that unassembled furniture. I leave such labors for our young roving correspondent. But this was a special case. With a title like that, which purported to explain exactly why girls are weird, I was thinking that I'd have a few clues as to why a particularly attractive cocktail waitress slapped me in the face the other night at the bar. I assure you, dear listeners, that I did nothing but compliment her. I simply told her that she had very nice breasts that I would like to spend a weekend nuzzling in. I meant no harm. I was simply stating a fact. I was being polite. But she apparently took offense, and I am now 86 from the bar. Why Girls Are Weird was not, in fact, a psychology book, but a novel with a pink cover. While reading this book in a diner over my meatloaf dinner, some muscular gentleman came up to me and invited me to something called a pride parade. I told them I had enough pride already and didn't need to attend some silly parade to improve my own confidence. I had plenty of that already, but I did thank them all the same for their invitation. Needless to say, the book did not provide answers, but hopefully this interview will.
So I am here in front of Cafe Strada with Pamela Ribbon, who just happens to be in town and who happens to also have a new book called Why Moms Are Weird. Pam, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Well, if I were a little younger and I didn't have a Y chromosome, I suspect this would be very similar to Tess meeting Anna Kay.
Yes, I suppose so. It's a little fancier. I'd be really worried when Tess showed up, she had microphones.
Oh, yeah. That's if Tess down the road a few years. I don't
know. Exactly.
Well, anyway, let's talk about why moms are weird and how it compares to why girls are weird. I was reading this and I was thinking it's almost like you could have called it why families are weird, because it actually is not exclusively about the mother. It's also about a number of other things.
That's true. Why did you
settle in on this why moms are weird? Was this kind of like a sort of way to kind of cash in on the previous one? Or maybe you can talk about this.
The original title was I'm Not Your Problem. And because Benny is avoiding dealing with whichever problem it is and has a lot of things that she's blaming. But at the time, the publishing house really wanted Why Girls Are Weirder or Why Girls Are Weird Too. And when I was thinking about what I was going to write before I'd written the book, my friend said, what are you going to call? What is it about? And I said, it's kind of about my mom dating. It's kind of like why moms are weird. And then
was this as you were writing it, this they needed the title, or
they needed the title before I'd started writing it?
Okay.
Yes,
it's almost like one of those Roger Corman pictures where he would actually make the poster and then he'd actually go ahead and then make the film based around the title and the poster.
That's exactly what happened. This cover was made before I had finished writing the book.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so I'm lucky that it didn't.
But there's not much in the way of Tupperware. I didn't really recall any Tupperware in this.
No Tupperware. I should have gone back and found some Tupperware.
So you're scamming the readers here.
Well, no. I mean, it's, you know, the tone of the book. It's a I don't know. Look, it's a franchise. It's blue instead of orange.
Well, if it's a franchise, though, why didn't some of the characters from Why Girls Are Weird appear in this?
Well, I think the title is the franchise. Here's what.
Okay.
You're making it very. How do I explain?
I just want to know. That's all.
It's all about the bookstore and getting. I guess it's hard to sell. It's getting harder and harder to sell Chick Lit, and this is still considered Chick Lit, regardless of what's between the pages, because Downtown Press is a Chick Lit imprint. So, calling it something different or having it. There are 3 years between my first book and this one, so it's one way to keep people remembering, oh, she wrote Why Girls Are Weird. Here's why moms are weird. Look, I'm struggling with it every day, but yeah.
Why dolphins are weird.
Why dolphins are weird. Why cats are weird.
Okay, well.
Why my hoodie's weird.
Let's talk about this, you know, this categorization of Chick Lit. Do you feel, what are your feelings on Chick Lit? I mean, there's a lot of controversy going on. The Nell Frudenberger essay in the New York Times Book Review. People are either castigating it or loving it or wrapping their arms around it. I mean, it's sort of like it's our latest genre. I'm surprised we don't have like a Chick Lit section next to the mystery or the science fiction section.
Well, some bookstores do, but they call it summer reads or for her.
For her.
Yes, it's very pink and lots of shoes. But, well, I used to think when the first one came out that it was not the worst thing in the world, because the genre made it so it was at the front of the store. There was a lot of attention to it. You could, you know, buy two, get one free. And at least then it was easier to find. But now it has sort of been pushed to the side like a chick flick. It's dismissed in that sort of chick flick way,
yeah,
where it doesn't really matter. They'll say, oh, it's pretty good for chick lit. It's already down a notch in terms of a novel that even if you're not doing the single sassy girl looking for love, it still gets that same sort of book cover. Here I am next to my blue book cover, but
which I have seen for the first time just now.
Yeah. But it is. It's a very chick litty cover. The font is very silly, and
but I'll have you know, I got looks reading this on the bus.
Well, yeah.
As a male, this is another sort of divide issue that we have. It's that how do we kind of cross the boundaries here to have more men or more Y chromosome types
That's
reading
true.
Chick lit? You know?
I do have a lot of male readers on my website too, which is unapologetically girly. The website,
yeah.
It's pretty girly. I don't know. How do you get it so that it's considered like Nick Hornby's writing, which is the same themes, it's the same sort of thing, but from a male perspective.
Of course, yeah.
So,
well, the thing I actually noticed, and I wanted to ask you this, is that this book opens up with a stabbing, a very unusual stabbing in the foot. And now, I read Jennifer Weiner's last book, Good Night Nobody,
mm-hmm.
and that also began with a really strange stab.
Did it really?
Yeah. And I don't know if you channeled that or if there's some sort of new chick-lit kind of code going around where all the authors just, like, have to stab someone in a really strange way, you know?
Yes, perhaps. I don't know. I'll have to check with her on that. Well, you know, when the first book came out, the Margaret Atwood book came out, I'm going to say this incorrectly, Oryx and Crake, is that what it was?
Yeah, you got it.
Had a chapter about a channel of a woman named Anna Kay, who was like a reality show about her. So it was like a live blog, but it sounded like my book.
Yeah.
They came out in the same month.
And you had no connection with Anna Kay in that?
No, I had no connection to Margaret Atwood in any way.
Well, of course. Well,
so I don't know. It's something about ideas when they're out there. You know, like a bunch of books or movies tend to have themes that are similar at the same time. I think that, I don't know, there's some sort of collective consciousness.
Sure.
Perhaps.
Well, let's talk about Downtown Press, which is a relatively new imprint that mm-hmm. Actually sort of is kind of allowing. What it's saying is that basically it's the imprint with single woman on a journey of some sort, and it's a more edgy sort of chick lit than the norm.
Yeah.
Did they approach you? Did you approach them? How did this happen? And did they sort of like say, "Hey, Pam, we need like a single woman on a journey"?
Yeah. They approached me, but I had. I had written why. Oh no! We've had a terrible party foul here.
No problem. We're okay.
No, normally I'm the one spilling the coffee. So.
Yeah. But I'm spilling it on equipment. But keep going.
Give me another 5 minutes, I'll join you.
I can multitask here.
I wrote Why Girls Are Weird, and we were looking for a publishing house, and it went up on a small bidding war. And Downtown Press was new; they hadn't even launched yet, so they were looking for a few books to launch around. Zane was actually the, and she's a African-American erotica writer.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure how it was.
She doesn't have a last name,
I understand. It's just Zane.
Yeah.
Zane. And I don't know why they read my book and thought this goes alongside Zane's, but they did. And they were explaining Downtown Press to me. I think at the time, Red Dress Inc. was sort of the biggest one, and they were getting ready to launch, and they wanted this to be this one. Downtown Press wanted this to be one of their first ones. So they didn't make me change it in any way, but they thought it fit the tone of what they were looking for in terms of their chick-lit imprint.
Now, I have to comment that, you know, your depiction of men in this is actually quite interesting. Without giving too much away, you mm-hmm. have this Zach character who mm-hmm. is in a relationship but also somehow smitten mm-hmm. with Benny. And also, it's interesting that Benny goes to Benihana. I don't know if that was intended.
No. Thanks.
No.
opening my mind.
I thought that there was some sort of like little wordplay going on there.
That's good.
And then you also have this guy, Mickey, who, you know, who is... It's very strange that the men fall into these two categories. And I'd like to ask you about, like, you know, why are the men in this book quite sort of, I don't know, exuberant or sort of heady or passionful, you know, with all this kind of strange kind of giddy charge of attraction going on?
towards her or all the men, like even the mom's boyfriends?
Well, not the mom's boyfriends so much. I mean, they're probably like more of the, you know, more level-headed and more grounded, you know, which, and that's another thing we'll talk about in just a sec. But maybe, is the genre itself kind of, you know, does it sort of beckon you to portray men or even women in a particular way that you feel that you have to kind of rope yourself into a certain kind of, I guess, gender depiction? Or?
Let's see. Your coffee's making me so nervous.
No, it's okay. It's
I don't think that's on correctly. There you go. Let's see. I want to answer this correctly, but I think that I'm writing based off of people that I know or people that I've come into contact with or love stories that I've admired, and I know a lot of passionate people. So I think, which sounds so stupid, but I think that when I hear them talking in my head or when I think about how I would be in that situation, when you're dealing with unrequited love or love that can be taken away from you, I think you do get kind of heady and passionate. And if you're dealing with a guy who takes a step back from it, when you've already taken a step back from it, then it could die. And I think that because Benny was leaving, that created the frenzy in Mickey that she hadn't really experienced before. I had her, you know, kind of doubting love. So she needed some people who were pretty sure of it for her to start to believe it at all. If someone approached her in that same manner that she was feeling in any sort of apathy, I don't think she would have noticed. I think it would have felt that she was being proven correct.
But it's also interesting that you have like these, even Lloyd Dobler in the first book, mm-hmm. He says, I love you, like, you know, just without even meeting Anna Kay.
Well.
I mean, there's the men sort of jump to these sorts of I love you kind of conclusions, which is, you know, I mean, men are typically not going to go that crazy, like, from the get-go, I would argue. But also simultaneously, I mean, I'm just wondering if the portrayal of men or women in the book is kind of guided in some sense by the narrative that you set down. Mm-hmm. Is narrative something of a trap? Because your work sort of has these sort of very ebullient kind of characters. And maybe you could talk about the sort of plotting versus character. Is this a sort of struggle for you as a fiction writer? Or?
I know where the book's going to end, and I tend to know who I want her to come into contact with. But the beginning is the hardest part for me in a book, which it doesn't always happen when I'm writing television or scripts or anything. But with the book, I really have to hear that person's voice, and it generally I learn has to be mine. So so maybe that's what it is. I have found that in my relationships, I'm usually the later one to say I love you. So perhaps the reason that it comes in these books is the pressure that I've felt or the way that my relationships have gone, I am the one that people are like, we're in love, why can't you see this?
Yeah.
You know? So you've gotta keep it in the, you've gotta put it, what am I trying to say here? I guess with the plot, I know that they have to be in love in order for them to not be in love, in order for them to be in love. And I also try not to make the main story be about the love story. In both cases, I really want it to be more about what she's going through. And almost the love story almost becomes pesky. And so that's why I have the men be a little more frenzied about it, because then they can't be ignored. If it seems like, why is she not just dealing with her mom and her sister, she's got to have these guys really pressuring her, or I think it would look girly if all she's doing is obsessing over men she probably couldn't get or doesn't have any business being around.
So the gist I'm getting here is that in order for you to sort of stand out as a writer, you need to have some additional kind of narrative thrust going on, like in, you know, Why Girls Are Weird, you have the whole, you know, popularity of the internet site, the stalker, and all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, you have, like, the whole mother sort of situation. Is this kind of a way to, I guess, maintain your interest in terms of, like, you know, maintain your focus and your interest as a writer? Or?
You mean me while I'm writing the
book?
Or
do you need a challenge, or do you need to stand out? What is it, the motivation here?
It seems that I've written some books in between that aren't getting published. Two of them were reality show satires, and one is a third-person story about stand-up comedy. What seems to work for Downtown Press, anyways, when I'm writing from my own point of view about, I'm just sort of slightly fictionalizing my life. So it's not really to keep myself entertained, and it's not really to write a chick lit novel, but the way that the book comes out of me and it sounds like me, I guess, isn't necessarily trying to find a new way to write chick lit, but fictionalizing what I've been writing about in the blog, I guess. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it definitely does. Let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go okay. back through time
okay.
you know, and do some sort of, you know, insert your doo-la-doo thing yeah. here.
Oh, it's early time. Yeah. It's 98 and the blogs.
Back in 1990.
There were no blogs. Yeah. Picture it.
Yes. Picture a landscape of the internet where it's all really bright pink and yellow colors.
That's right.
Where there is no such thing as a blog.
You
were
a member.
Just a personal website.
That's right. You were a member of newsgroups.
Yeah.
Alt.
You had Flame Wars and Usenet. Yeah.
You did have Flame Wars and Usenet. It's true.
Well, anyway, let's talk about how you went from a blogger to where we are now.
To where I am now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and maybe, like, you know, because you've gone through a lot of different interesting sort of, you've weaved through a lot of strange areas that have kind of led you to where you are right now.
That's true.
And you're still kind of, I would argue, too, that you're sort of still juggling, like, you know, about six balls at the same time here.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't really know what I want to be when I grow up still. Well, I started as an acting major at UT Austin, and while I was there, I had a boyfriend who was into computers, and I had already been on the internet at the computer labs at school, and we were playing around with Gopher and Veronica and chat, like the first chat rooms, and he made a website. And I asked him how I could do that, and he said, the web's not for girls. And then that made me want to learn it even more. So I was on the IRC, and which is where, gosh, remember when porn was so free and on the IRC? there was just so much of it.
I don't know what you're talking about. It still is so free, but anyway.
But it was so in your living room. I don't know. Anyway, it seems like there are, we're just going to cut this part out. Anyway, the point is, I taught myself how to make a website, and I had the same sort of personal website that everybody had with the animated GIF of the envelope with a letter going into it so you could email me. And then I made a trivia game of movie quotes, and you had to guess the movie quote, and we played the Kevin Bacon game, and you got points. So anyway, I started working at IBM when I was almost done with college, and it looked like I was working whenever I was typing. Between calls, I was doing tech support. So I made myself a website. I'd met a girl out here, actually, in Berkeley, and she had an online journal, and said, this is how you can keep up with me. So I was reading hers and followed some links and read about 15 or 20 of them and thought, well, this sure looks like I'm working. And I was doing sketch comedy out there in Austin at the time, so I used the website to keep myself doing a writing exercise, and then it just kind of took off from there. And I started getting other work. I was using it as a portfolio, and I started writing for a few websites. I got a column in the Austin American Statesman, like a weekly. I'm like, if Andy Rooney was a 25-year-old girl, it was like, what's the deal with mouse pads? And then I was writing anime scripts. I was writing the American dub script for Japanese anime, and saving money doing all of those jobs at once, went out to L.A. And by then, I was my website was running ads. It was a part of a portal. So I was making a living writing Pammy.com.
When did the first book kind of factor into this? And when did the sort of, did the anime kind of lead to writing teleplays? Or
no, the anime did not lead to anything, but it paid some bills. The teleplays, well, I guess once you move out to L.A., you got to have something. So I wrote a couple of I wrote the teleplays first and entered contests, and that's how I got an agent. And wrote a screenplay after that, and then the book came out. I sold the book in 2002, in May of 2002, and it came out in the summer of 2003. And then we optioned the rights for that. Would you actually make more money optioning the movie rights for a book that, for a movie that'll never get made, than you do writing a book?
It's one of the great Hollywood scams, isn't it? This whole notion of, like, getting paid to have unproduced screenplays.
Yes, I wrote.
I know Scott Smith, like, he just came out with The Ruins, and he had a situation where that's how basically he survived for the last, you know, 13 years. He just wrote all these scripts that never got made.
Yeah, that's what I did for a year. I wrote two versions of Why Girls Are Weird. And now the rights are mine again. So maybe I'll go through it again. That'd be nice. But that was hard, writing a movie based off of the book that's based off of the website that's based off of your life. There are two things that happen. One is they ask who's going to play Anna Kay, and that's weird. But the other one is when they give you notes and say things like, we find the main character to be rather pathetic. And it's something you actually did in life, where they're debating why would anybody actually do that. And it's from my real life, and that was fun.
Well, do you find, what's the difference between like writing in a screenplay or teleplay form versus writing fiction? Do you find that each has their own respective advantages or certain kinds of delights or pleasures? Or is it just, you know, really hard labor? Or maybe you can talk about this.
Well, they all have their own rhythm. Yeah. They have the sound that you know that it's working. And when you're doing a sitcom, I don't know. I could go on for this too long and sound very dorky, but in my head they sound different. They feel different. It's like listening to different kinds of music. So I like going back and forth between them. But the main thing is you write a book kind of by yourself, and you write a screenplay by yourself while every once in a while visiting people. But a TV show, there's always a lot of people involved. So it depends on whether or not you want to write with 12 people, or you want to write for a little while by yourself.
Yeah, gotcha. What was I going to say? Well, I was going to, you were mentioning earlier about this 3-year gap where you weren't able to get another manuscript published and mm-hmm. because these weren't chick lit. Mm-hmm. Has this been sort of a problem for you as a sort of, you know, as an author? I mean, you know, in terms of like, you know, again, this kind of harkens back to the whole chick lit debate, whether, you know, someone is irrevocably sort of pegged in to that niche, and is known for that particular niche. Because, I mean, if you look at also, for example, Why Girls Are Weird, it has the distinction of having all of this kind of, representations of email, of blog entries, of chat, and mm-hmm. the like, you know? So, which is not your typical, you know, book in any form. You know?
And it's never mentioned in articles about bloggers getting book deals. Yeah. It is absolutely never mentioned. And it's never really mentioned as a blog book either, and it's interesting. It just sort of went underneath. I don't know exactly how it did that, but it's never brought up when they're talking about MySpace or people meeting online. But anyway,
not that you're bitter.
No, I'm not bitter, but it's interesting that there's a whole book about it. And
right, also the chapters are like, you know, HTML. You know,
yeah.
And maybe you should have had 0001.html or
guess.
Something. Maybe that would have, you know. But anyway.
Maybe. But the second book I wrote before the first one came out, because I didn't want to get nervous in case the first book didn't do very well and never write again. So I wrote just the story in my head, knowing it wasn't chick lit. And so Simon & Schuster Downton Press wasn't very interested in it right then. They said, can we use it later? Can we establish some books in a similar voice first? Or you can try and sell it somewhere else under a pseudonym. And then the first thing we did was try and sell it somewhere else. And we got a lot of responses like, this is too dark or too literary, particularly for, I guess, the kind of books that the kind of book I'm known for, or whatever it was. I think maybe I was too young and the book needs some work. The next one was trying to satisfy Downtown Press at my book deal, but I think I was writing, I think, again, it was my fault. The book just wasn't very good. What I got to a point was I was very frustrated trying to do what I thought was fit into a chick lit niche and make it chick litty. And I thought I'd answered everything on the checklist, like sassy girl on town wearing cute shoes with a girlfriend, and but there wasn't anything that felt true. So my editor said, what's going on in your life? Like, why don't you write about something going on? And I realized that's when I realized what she meant. And it didn't matter whether or not it's a sassy girl about town. If I'm writing about an extension of me or what I've been going through at that age, that's probably what I think the essence of chick lit is, why we go back and read these books. Is it's not that we're wanting these lives of these women. We're identifying with their weakest points and hoping that we learn things in the way that they do.
Did you ever, in the course of this, consider like approaching a small independent publisher? Because if this was too literary, I mean, do you find that, you know, having to turn out a sort of chick lit title is kind of, I guess, not as distinct, perhaps, as you may like it.
Right. I know that we sent it to a lot of places. It's quite a big stack. My editor or my agent sent it to a number of houses, and it to the point where it wasn't that they had given up. It was that at one point I came up with an idea for the reality show book, and Simon and Downtown Press really did want another book from me, so they offered a deal, and it made us have to put the other one aside. So I don't know if I had decided not to do another Chick Lit book, would we have found success in a small press? Possibly. But I also, when they said we're not giving up on this, can you let it be your fourth book? That certainly sounds like appealing. That I could write three books and they'll do that as the fourth. You know, that's really lucky.
But that on the downside of things, if there's this sort of like, you know, unfortunate, and I don't think it's necessarily deserved, stigma of like, oh, Pam Ribbon. Chick Lit author,
right?
As opposed to Pam Ribbon author, you know,
right.
Doesn't that kind of get in the way of your perception? Because I mean, you know, if you've done three books, then you're at that point, you have some kind of idea of, you know, where you're going, or at least some perception of you that the, you know, that Downtown can then, you know, market.
Yeah. Well, I am very naive, and in this book world, because it's very strange to be in LA and do books because it's so removed. And the only the last person to be impressed with you writing a book is someone in L.A. When you go to New York, they're like, oh, you write books, but in L.A., it's, what else do you do?
Unless you're in Brooklyn, because everyone's a writer in Brooklyn.
Right, exactly, unless you're in Park Slope. But so here's why I'm naive. I would hope that if Downtown Press knows that they're dealing with a book that isn't necessarily Chick Lit, that they work on marketing it a bit differently for that one. But again... I could be, it may be time for me to buy a publicist at that point. I don't really know how you do it. I mean, in terms of my television stuff, I've gone from working for the Oxygen Network or writing a super girly sitcom to writing for Mind and Mencia on Comedy Central, which is aggressively male, and I have been able to go back and forth. And I don't know if that's... Well, my agent's really good, but I don't know if that's because of the material I write can go from one to the other and nobody cares, or if I'm known as someone who can go back and forth. I'm not sure. It's too early. It's all very early.
It's interesting, too. There was actually an article, I believe, in The Telegraph today that basically, you know, said, novelists, why can't they write plays? So if we do have this kind of, like, AC/DC thing going on here, well, that's fantastic because, you know, it's a rarity often. I mean, Harold Pinter, if you hear or read one of his plays, there's a fundamental difference between the plays and that dialogue then being transposed to the novel.
How would you have the silence? Just pages
well,
and
yeah,
pages
exactly.
of white? Yeah.
Well, you can't just, like, read a book and it's like, you know, hey, how's the... do you have the butter? Yes, I've got the butter. You got the butter? I got the butter. That Pinter sort of... I mean, that just is not going to fly in a novel, but it will fly in a play.
But you can write the novel so that it's timed out as you're reading it, how it is in the play. That's what I meant about the rhythm. So, but I don't know that everybody does that,
sure.
You know, or thinks they can do that if you're writing a book. I know people who think, well, I couldn't write that. I write this, but... You could.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I want to actually ask you about sort of a theme that's in both of your books that is actually more pronounced in Why Moms Are Weird, and that is the whole compartmentalization of men. You have this in Anna Kay a little bit, where you have the Lloyd Dobler character, and you have the other guy who she's with, and then like you have the sort of friend guy, Dale, you know. So there's a little bit of a kind of foreshadowing of what you pursue with considerable vigor with the mother character in Why Moms Are Weird. So what draws you to this particular theme? Is this something you're particularly intrigued in terms of, you know, I know women who do this where they spread their, you know, they spread their interest across multiple men, hoping, but instead of actually trying to, you know, accept one person for her flaws. It's vaguely polyamorous, actually.
Wow. Well, let's see. That's a very good question. I've never really thought about it that way. I have a lot of friends. A lot of them are male. My mom, this is all, there's no way to answer this without getting very personal. Let's see, what's the best way to do this?
Do you know a friend who we won't mention? Has no relation to you personally
right.
whatsoever.
Right. well.
I mean, okay, how about, let me help you out here. Okay.
Thanks.
So, without, you know, going into personal sort of details, what about this particular issue draws you into this kind of compartmentalization question?
By compartmentalization, you do mean that this is the guy I use for this and this is the guy I use for this?
No, okay, I should explain myself then. No, what I was suggesting, it was sort of like that. I didn't mean... I see what you're saying and I see what I'm saying. I'm sort of saying, like, splitting one's kinds of needs across multiple partners, irrespective of gender.
Okay.
Where you have a situation where, you know, okay, this person fulfills... I mean, that's why it seems very much like polyamory. That's
the weird
thing, because it's like polyamorists. Oh, this person's my friend person. This person I have great sex with. This person I, like, have romantic feelings with. And they all kind of fulfill different needs. And it's very interesting that you've done this within the form of kind of a sort of... It's kind of like it's a monogamy, but at the same time, if you actually take that template and apply it to polyamory, it's a lot of similarities.
Yes.
I'm just, maybe you can, you know, what is it about this topic or this, I mean, you know, forget the polyamory aspect, I mean, which I just kind of threw in there as a parallel.
I know what you mean. Yeah. But it's all about dysfunction,
yeah.
Right? Particularly why moms are weird is a very heightened look at dysfunction, and I think that that's where that comes from. When you're dysfunctional, you are always looking for something you feel like is missing. So maybe it's this person that makes you feel a little bit better about this, and it's this person who makes you feel a little prettier, and this one makes you feel a little worse, and you keep all of these different people. If there was just one person who could do all of them, well, maybe you wouldn't be dysfunctional. But that feeling of I'm not getting enough and I can't be enough is the heart of that. So this is a number of people who... You know, in a family, you have your role, and in any relationship, you have your role, and when you want to change that, it really screws up the whole family dynamic. So in the case of Why Moms Are Weird, the father being gone makes everybody not know exactly how to deal with each other, and when they're trying to deal with each other how they used to, it doesn't work because there's someone missing. So you start looking for that feeling of, well, he's missing, and this person made me feel this, this, and this. So you're going from person to person. Or you were taking more from your existing relationships.
But also families, though, have a tendency to sort of shift when, like, say, someone dies or someone is gone, where, you know, responsibilities or roles or perceptions kind of, like, fall upon another, you know, another person without getting personal here.
Right,
I actually
see
this in my own family, you know?
Right, and then you either accept that graciously and want to, or you resent it. And you're trying to push it off on someone else, or you then say, fine, then I want this that I'm missing from that person. And sometimes you go outside your family, or sometimes you hit hard at your family. So, you know, I moved a lot growing up, and so I was constantly meeting new people and making new friends, and so I think maybe that's what you're seeing, too, is I would go to a new place and not really know anybody and think, okay, well, who's going to be my... Are you good enough of a friend that I can be really good friends with you? And then also that knowledge of, this isn't going to last because I got to move. And I'm going to move and you're not going to write to me anymore, even though you say you will. So I think maybe that desperateness, that rushed part of relationships that you're picking up might be because my relationships have always been kind of rushed and have a fever to them that maybe most people don't. I wouldn't know.
Gotcha.
It would be nice.
Nice maneuver out, I have to say. Oh, yeah, the use of technology in your works. You know, there is actually very little in the way of email and Why Moms Are Weird until near the end. I was like, oh, there's a bit of an email here.
Couldn't get away from it.
There's also references to iPods. What is it that kind of draws you to... technology and is this kind of like sort of an ineluctable part of your fiction or what?
Well, I think it's the reality of your everyday. There's so much of it that I feel like I'm always, when you're watching a movie, you're like, well, why doesn't he just call her? Or she totally has her cell phone on. You know, he'd just text her. Like, all those things bother me. So I feel like you need to put them in a modern story. Wow, you were not kidding that this coffee...
No, I'm telling you. Isn't it great?
Yeah, I felt a tremor.
No, I'm telling you. I was not lying. That's
why you spilled it.
Yeah,
woo!
Yeah. No, I know. It's,
okay.
It's a huge jolt. It's like you see God.
I am... There's a halo. Everything's good.
I know.
Like, your questions are awesome, and we're best friends. See? I love you. Is it too soon? Here we go. So, technology.
The legalist thing you could, the most legal thing you could do aside from a nickel bag here in Berkeley.
That's right. Oh, man, this stuff's good. Okay. White chocolate. The Strada Bianca Mocha, everybody. Yes. Look into it.
Which is a, yeah.
Woo! So, technology. Well, in the past hour, I posted on my blog, I beamed a picture that I took on my camera phone yesterday to my blog, posted a link to this website because I was coming here to talk about the book that's kind of because of my blog, and then looked up where I was going on the phone. It just seems like in an hour I did all of that without even thinking, wow, should I use technology a lot? That to keep it out of the books, it feels like you're writing about a different time, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could, but it wouldn't feel like what I would do in those situations, I guess.
But I suppose, though, there's something to be said about the way you pursue technology and how, you know, I mean, there was another article I think I read today, and I can't remember where, that was just remarking, of course, like, on how online dating has dramatically sort of shifted contemporary culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and these are things to sort of think about in terms of fiction. It's like, you know, now it's like, well, you know, there's Match.com, there's Craigslist for these sorts of things. There's these long-distance relationships, mm-hmm. you know? And
when My Girls Are Weird came out, it was still considered pretty bizarre to meet someone that you only knew online, and it was still considered rather freaky. And now it is pretty commonplace, but I think that it's really one of the more romantic ways to fall in love, because when you're emailing someone, you have the subject line, right, which is a way to get their attention already. Then you have the use of white space, whether or not you're going to use capital letters or lowercase. The lowercase letters always seem more intimate. How quickly you write back shows how much attention you give that person. If you then move it to their cell phone, no matter where they are, you're thinking about them, so you can see why I'm dysfunctional. But it's its own way of love letter writing that's so intimate and deals with, has timing that you can't have in just a letter. And you can go back and forth so quickly. You can have the same thought at the same time on IM, and you're not even, you know, you're not using your voice. You're not looking at the other person. It's just your insides talking to someone else's insides, you know.
But it's also a dramatic shift towards, you know, face-to-face interaction, which I feel is an integral, not inevitable.
Well,
no,
it is.
I'm not online dating right now. No, it's like, it's an integral component of, you know, everyday discourse. You're
sure.
going to get more from, like, you and I talking right here. The fact that we can actually do this live is far more, you know, we're able to respond, and I'm able to, you know, say things to you in a way that is, you know, because there are expressions in the face mm-hmm. and the like. And that this has got to, you know, as a result, you know, so where was I going with this? I was actually just going to go on a total rant here. I apologize.
No, it's okay. Is it better? I think I was sort of saying that the that there's a pure form of romance to the way that we can talk to each other and fall in love.
Yeah.
And I think you were going to argue that that's crap, which I see what you mean.
No, I was just playing the devil's advocate
here.
I think there's room for both ideas.
But getting to know someone initially without having to deal with the awkwardness of face-to-face, when you're a writer anyway, is awesome.
No,
I use
no,
the worst word to describe something
know,
so
though.
Better.
If you, like, just, you know, run into someone at the coffee house that, you know, seems interesting and get involved in the conversation, you're going to, you know, that's going to be, to my mind anyway, less nervous than if you were actually go ahead and, like, oh, I'm corresponding with this person who sounds really cool. They could turn out to be a psycho killer. They could turn out to have bad breath or whatnot, you know?
Well, you got to go back to me being dysfunctional. Yeah. So if I met you at a coffee shop and we had a nice conversation, I'm probably going to think that you thought I was a giant dork. But if you emailed me and you're inside the coffee shop and I'm outside the coffee shop and that's all we know, but I can see you writing to me and I'm writing to you, I'm going to feel more confident. Look, I'm just weird, but I'm going to feel more confident because I can see you and then I can look down and tell you something. In my own words, without me stammering or giggling as I talk, as I do, or looking at the floor, and I can see how quickly you write back. And you'll be able to see my reaction. I don't know how to explain this, but it's flirting without, I guess you can be braver in the flirting.
Yeah.
Because you're removed just a spot from it.
I'm wondering if this is one of the reasons you got involved with like stand-up comedy and writing and things like this. I guess it sounds to me like you're kind of a shy person, you know?
Yes, but I don't think anybody would have ever said that. I think if you asked any of my friends, they would not say I'm shy.
No, I mean I'm a shy extrovert myself, yeah. So you know. Mm. So we're on the same team here.
Yeah, that's how you end up doing this stuff. Yeah. Yes, I feel more comfortable. I do a 40-minute one-person show. I don't do 10 minutes of stand-up. I don't do stand-up because I don't think anybody would think I'm funny in 7 minutes. But if you give me an hour, I might be more endearing. And I don't do things quickly and just have that kind of confidence. It does take me a little bit. I am shy.
There's nothing wrong with it. There was a Jonathan Rauch article years ago about getting in touch with your inner introvert. I'm sure you're familiar with this.
No, I'm not.
Really?
I'm going to write it down.
Okay, yeah. And basically saying there were people who felt like sort of awkward at parties,
mm-hmm.
But felt totally at home with like, you know, one or two people, you know, that's mm-hmm. kind of thing. He and this created a huge sort of splash on the internet. It was forwarded to everyone. And even Neal Stephenson had actually, like, you know, linked to it on his one rare little, you know, website or whatnot. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe this is the type of, you know, type. Anyway,
yeah.
This is now going into the personal, and that's not what I intended.
Sure, it wasn't.
No, I'm sorry, I kid you not.
Well, it is. It's interesting because I take meetings in LA all the time, and you basically sit down
you run away
a complete
with
stranger. Huh?
You have to take them out the door. You abscond
that's
with
right.
the meetings. Why don't they say
we
I
call
abscond
it take
with
meetings?
Meeting,
I take the five. Look, I take the five to the ten. Oh, those are the highways. I take the five to the ten to the meeting that I take. But we do a lot of taking in LA, not a lot of giving. But I'm sitting down with a complete stranger, and in an hour, I've got to make them think I'm fun and exciting, and I don't really get nervous at those. But why is it that I would? I was awkward sitting here before we even turned these things on.
Yeah.
And you're not giving me a job, so I don't know. I don't know. I'm now very curious as to why I'm so shy. But I wouldn't be if we had done this in an email interview at all.
Yeah, well, you're doing fantastically.
Thanks.
I've loosened up quite a bit.
Okay, good.
Okay, well, actually, I want to actually ask you here. Okay, so getting off the personal, getting off the whole shy thing, and getting off any sort of sense of making you feel self-conscious.
Okay.
Let's talk about the work.
Yes.
Which is generally what I do.
Okay.
The thing about Why Moms Are Weird that was funny to me is that there are a lot of scenes in this where women are putting on these clothes that are like several sizes too small for them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it does relate to the revelation towards the end, but aside from that, it seemed to be a very interesting kind of fixation of yours. Maybe you can talk about this.
Clothes that don't fit right?
Clothes that don't fit right or that are obviously clearly don't fit in the state of sort of being uncomfortable in a fitting room as this thing that's clearly like half the size of, you know,
yeah.
Talk about this. This is an issue that I think you really wanted to dig up here.
Well, in LA, there's a lot of clothes not fitting right. You just see that a lot. But people wear tiny clothes. But if you're in my family, clothes have always been an issue. And my sister always wears things too small for her. And I used to always wear things too big for me. And, it does go back to being shy, whether or not you're comfortable in your own clothes. And I find that you can have a day where you leave the house. And the second you leave the house and get in your car, you realize you wore the wrong clothes. They don't fit right. I was talking to a friend of mine about this a couple days ago, and she said that she actually drove to the Gap and bought herself something else to wear because she left the house in the wrong clothes. Just knew the whole day was going to be crappy if she didn't change. And I think your clothes do influence how you feel all day, and particularly if you're dealing with a new body and you just notice things and how they fit. I also just, I am very aware of my clothes, even though it doesn't look like it, because I don't dress like I care about my clothes.
This is radio. You can wear whatever you want.
Exactly. But before I came here, I just posted that I was coming here, and I said that it was radio, but more importantly, what was I going to wear? And I wrote what I was wearing. So it's weird that you asked this question, but I do think that I think about clothes a lot. Why? I'm not sure. We went from getting a lot of our stuff from like Goodwill and garage sales and donations, and then I went through a really bad clothing period where I dressed, you know, baggy jeans and boxer shorts and flannel, and this is all very Seattle. And then And then you move to some place like LA where your clothes are sort of important in a way that when you're going to take a meeting, all you have is how you look. And I really haven't thought this much about my clothes out loud, but I guess I do think about them. And I'm answering your question very long because of the Strada Bianca Mocha.
Hey, that's totally,
I totally blame
this,
that.
This is the magic of the Strada Bianca Mocha.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Well, okay. This actually, I'll tie this in very skillfully to something that I've observed in both of the books, and that is you have it, I wasn't sure. Initially, I thought that this was the fact that you also wrote teleplays and screenplays, but you'll read a chapter of yours, and it will sometimes be just all dialogue, and then sometimes you'll, like, you know, be concerned with environment in ways that you just, like, sometimes you will latch on to a particular environment to describe it. Sometimes you'll make no mention of it. Maybe you can sort of describe what motivates whether you describe an environment or not. Or is it a matter of just, like, since these are all sort of short chapters, are these, like, just bursts that you kind of write in one sort of sitting? Or
I do write them in one sitting like that. They do come out in little things. I have I tend to have a document that very quickly says what'll happen in the next couple chapters, and then I go back and forth. Sometimes I write something that was completely out of the book and then want to put it in and find a place to put it. And those tend to be the ones that are very environment heavy. It's just a thought that was going on in my head that I'll sit down and write about it. Like the Why Moms Are Weird, the chapter about having romantic relationships in the car.
Yeah.
I wrote that pretty late in the book, but realized after, I actually wasn't even writing it for the book. I just started, I think it was going to be a blog entry.
Yeah.
And then thought, actually, this works pretty well. And then what if, because they are going to be in the car, and then what if it ends with the car? And so I went and put it back in and made it sort of work through the book.
Huh. I was going to remark that this is actually very blog-like in the way you actually outdo these entries. You know?
Yes.
I mean, doing these chapters. See, I'm even messing up the terminology.
No, but you're right.
Here. Yeah.
And it's because I am trying to write in, you know, you have all these different voices when you write in all these different venues, mediums, whatever. Try the coffee. But so my TV voice, when you're writing for television, you have all these different people that you're emulating. And for my books, I'm supposed to try and remember my own.
Yeah.
So the best way for me to do that is to pretend I am writing a journal entry. By the way, I can't keep a diary on paper.
Really?
It's so boring. It ends up being like, I had some coffee and I like my shoes. So I have to have the audience.
Yeah.
So the audience for the book is the same audience that reads the website. So I have to write like I'm talking to them. And that's why it ends up coming out very blog-like. But what I did have to learn is that a chapter needs a hook and blog entries don't.
Yeah.
And I got so used to wrapping everything up in a tiny little piece that they didn't read like, it didn't read like a book. So often I have to go back, and maybe that's when it's dialogue heavier is when I'm trying to make you want to turn the page.
Huh. It seems to me that you almost would not have become a writer of books and films and television if you had not had the blog.
No.
And that it's very much a driving kind of, you know, inspirational paradigm, so to speak, for what you do even now.
Absolutely. In fact, like everyone in my life, every job I've had, every coworker, they've all come out of the blog, where I live and who I'm married to. And yeah, friends are married to people because they met on my website. Like, it really...
Yeah, I know.
It's a... we would never have thought. But I only put it down for about a year, the website, and that was when I focused on writing the book. Well, and because I couldn't afford it. It was about $500 a month to run Pammy.com.
Jesus Christ, you get that kind of traffic.
I did. Well, I guess I would if I kept the forum going the way it was.
That's just for text too. My goodness.
That was all bandwidth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, just text, and it was $500 a month. And now I don't know how much it would be if I wasn't lucky enough that a hosting company that I think is a kid with a server in his garage is letting me. I've got like a cell phone number. He's awesome. Miramid.net, everybody. But he really helps me out. But when it was up the first time, I used like a regular hosting company, and they would charge like you wouldn't believe. The bandwidth is high on a site like that, so but yeah, now it's like $15 a month, so it's
fine.
But I am paying to do it.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I had to remark, since we were talking about cars, I totally forgot about this. That's the red cars in this book.
The red cars, yes.
You know, again, talking about like how a lot of things in your life kind of came and originated from things that and exchanges that happen on the blog or the forums or whatnot. You know, is the red car sort of, I guess, kind of connoting a sort of, you know, magical kind of coincidental kind of thing? Is that what kind of drives some of the characters in this book? Or?
Yeah, I see those things all the time. I'm always giving meaning to what's probably just coincidence. Like hearing the songs in the Albertsons.
Yeah.
Or if I I saw your name on just a piece of paper over there, I don't let them be pure coincidences, and I don't know why. It's very strange, but because Mickey did that too for her, I felt like that was her starting to believe that there are people that are made for each other in some way.
Yeah.
And the fact that she hadn't really told him any of this stuff, and he just said, every time you see a red car, I want you to, that means I'm thinking about you.
Yeah.
He was talking in her language,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Does that answer your question? I'm trying to do them more succinctly.
No, it's totally, totally fine. I mean, you know. It does. And this kind of goes back to the whole dialogue-heavy thing. Maybe is it really, when you write a book or a teleplay, it's really a matter of, like, trying to find this kind of ambiguous kind of language where two characters kind of, you know, find a way of, it doesn't quite make sense to, you know, say another set of people,
mm-hmm.
to a more uptight set of people, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is fiction or writing for you an effort to kind of, you know, try to sort of, you know, capture these ambiguities or these little sort of patterns? Because there's a very, you know, there's a clear pattern in the way that you sort of, you know, write these books, it seems to me, and in a very sort of structured but yet idiosyncratic pattern, in the sense that it's modeled off of the whole, you know, the blog approach, which makes total sense, you know.
Right. What am I answering? I think that I'm trying to make it that the tiny little things that happen in our lives that we might not notice, or we make, or we can't help but notice and make into these. It's just, I have some motorcycle boys. It's all right.
Anyway.
Here in Berkeley.
They're going to Altamont.
They are. Either there are little moments that we tell ourselves not to pay attention to, or there are little moments that we obsess over and can't stop paying attention to. And I think that I like to write about those things because it's too easy to pretend they're no big deal. But they're actually, they're it. They're what we, they're the memories we make between each other, and they're the things that define us in ways that we wouldn't necessarily share. And when you find someone who's like, I do that too, that's the quickest way for two people to immediately know they're alike in a way that they think alienates them from everyone else. That's certainly why the blog got popular and I was interested in writing. What people weren't saying, like, oh, you're so funny, it was when people were writing and saying, I completely do that too. I thought nobody else did.
Yeah.
And so I feel like while I am sharing a lot of myself in a completely fictionalized way in these books, I'm also saying it's okay. I've been there. I'm going through it right now. I don't know what it all means. But if it makes you feel better for an hour before you go to sleep in your bed and it makes you laugh or cry or whatever, then it's like we got to hang out.
Huh.
And, you know, I'm always looking for a new friend.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you feel that maybe there might be an answer in blogs or writing towards? I mean, it also goes back to a peculiar sort of American characteristic in culture where we don't allow ourselves to actually have fun or play.
Mm-hmm.
We're very much a work-driven society. We're very much driven by, you know, if I were to meet you and I didn't know who you were, I'd say, hi, Pam, how are you doing? What do you do? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And meanwhile, we're all just saying, like, look at me. And that's what blogs are, just look at me. I'm so much more than my job. And the fact that we do them in our job, secretly or not secretly, is, I think, even, you don't usually do it when you get home. You find a time during your day, instead of playing solitaire, to say, look at me, I matter. And even if it's, here's pictures of my cat matters. Like, we're just trying to project and make us bigger than we feel. And then I think someone who writes a blog is very different than someone who reads a blog, because there are people who will read 30 or 40 of these and not write one of their own.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too. I can't imagine not writing one and being interested in them.
Yeah.
But But I do get email from people who read it, who've been reading me for 7 or 8 years, just to see what I'm going to do next. Like, I'm a soap opera.
Yeah.
And they, in fact, probably wouldn't say hi if they ended up at the table next to me, because I've gotten that too, an email like, I think I sat next to you today. But they didn't say anything, because it would be like breaking through your TV window and like shaking someone's hand, and it would ruin the illusion. You know?
It's a rather curious manner, in the sense that, you know, yes, we can be playful and actually tell each other that we matter, but we can't do so directly. It's very interesting. It's sort of like, it's not quite passive aggressivism. It's a little bit active, but yet it isn't. You know, it's sort of it's a dilemma. Well, Pam, it's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks
for putting up with the craze smoke and all that.
No, I'll never sleep again. Thank you. Weird science. Elastic tubes and pots and pans. Bits and pieces and magic from the handle. Make weird science. Four things I've never seen before. Behind all the doors, talent and imagination. Weird science. Not what teachers said to do. Making dreams come true. Living tissue, warm flesh. Weird science. Classic dudes and pots and pans, bits and pieces, bits and pieces.